are indiscriminate and thus prohibited. The British government is obligated under its own arms export laws to suspend arms exports licenses if it determines that there is a clear risk that British weapons might be used in violation of international law. Nevertheless, British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak told Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in October that his government will stand with Tel Aviv in solidarity. We will stand with your people and we want you to win. The governments of the UK, the United States and the European Union member states have been providing the child killer regime of Israel with weapons and military assistance since the regime launched its genocidal campaign in the Gaza Strip. The Zionist regime's ongoing bombardment of the besieged Gaza Strip has so far killed more than 24,000 people, over 10,000 of whom are infants and children. Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and this is Palestine Declassified. We're the only weekly show focusing on investigating and exposing the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. In this week's show, we'll be looking at South Africa's momentous application to the International Court of Justice. In its comprehensive 84-page submission, South Africa sets out the legal basis for its contention that Israel is perpetrating genocide in Gaza. It's historically significant that South Africa has taken the lead in holding Israel to account for its crimes against humanity. 30 years ago, Nelson Mandela said, "We know too well that our freedom is incomplete without the freedom of the Palestinians." Amina Taylor has been looking back at the links between South Africa and Palestine and the collaboration between South Africa's previous apartheid regime and the Zionist entity.
South Africa has taken the step to invoke the Genocide Convention and charge Israel in the International Court of Justice. While there are severe limitations to this process, it is undeniably momentous to see Israel brought before the highest international court to answer for its crime of genocide against the Palestinians. The relationship between South Africa and Palestine is deep and cannot be underestimated. It was forged through oppression and racial subjugation. Israel was a key player in the development and later the malignancy of apartheid rule in South Africa. South Africa's apartheid Prime Minister Daniel Malan was the first foreign Prime Minister to visit Tel Aviv following the Nakba. Hendrik Verwoerd, a South African apartheid architect and prime minister, even claimed in 1961 that Israel, like South Africa, is an apartheid state. That was six decades before Amnesty International said the same. In order to improve the image of apartheid in South Africa, Israel and the apartheid authorities established a joint secretariat for political and psychological warfare in 1975. By 1981, the apartheid army in South Africa had 200 Israeli military advisers, and hundreds of apartheid troops were also educated in Israeli military academies. Israeli military instructors provided direct guidance to the South African Reconnaissance Commando's elite unit in particular. Elbit Systems, Israel's largest arms business, played a key role in the development of South Africa's military electronics industry. South Africa's naval forces were also trained in Israel and sold radar systems by ELTA, a subsidiary of the state-owned Israeli Aerospace Industries. Israel was also essential to the construction of an electric wall to police the border of apartheid South Africa, with a crew of 50 Israeli technicians stationed permanently at the wall for maintenance. The Israelis also planted radar devices and minefields along the border. Israeli intelligence agencies had a steady presence in apartheid-era South Africa. The apartheid intelligence agency BOS ran a letterbomb campaign against ANC figures like Ruth First, which employed similar methods in its Operation Wrath of God against Palestinians in Lebanon. It is thought likely that Israel provided support for this. The Israel spy agency, the ADL, also spied on many anti-apartheid activists, including Archbishop Desmond Tutu, and sold the information to boss agents of the apartheid regime in South Africa. Israel and apartheid South Africa worked closely on nuclear research, with South African uranium proving extremely useful to Israel's covert nuclear program. Are we witnessing the revenge of history?
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and a former professor at Bristol University, and he's a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. David is also the co-founder and co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch. Our guest contributor today is Sam Hosseini, who joins us from Washington, D.C. via Skype. Sam is a Palestinian-American independent journalist who's been piercing through the establishment's falsifications for more than 25 years. He formerly worked for the media watchdog group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, and he's contributed to a variety of publications, including The Washington Post, USA Today, and Counterpunch. And as the senior analyst at the Institute for Public Accuracy, he's been writing for at least a decade about the case for invoking the Genocide Convention against Israel at the International Court of Justice. Welcome to the show. David, do you think Israel's history in supporting apartheid in South Africa had a role in this move?
Well, this is the revenge of history, and you can see in the demeanour and the cheers that went up when the South African legal team came back from The Hague, that this is seen as being a kind of an atonement for the sins of apartheid. And, of course, the hand held out to the Palestinian resistance and to the Palestinian people is a mark of how the South Africans see their struggle intertwined with that of the Palestinians. As of course, you said at the beginning, from that famous quote from Nelson Mandela, you know, who whatever else you might say about Mandela, and, you know, he's seen as this big, you know, saint in a way, and of course you can criticise his views, but whatever else you say about him, he was sold on the Palestinians.
Absolutely, and there was pressure on him not to be so when he was released, and he stood firm. But Sam, I mean, you were one of the first people pushing for a state to invoke the Genocide Convention, as I was saying in the introduction there. What convinced you that there was merit in pushing for this?
Several things. First off, I actually first really looked into this possibility in 2014 during the Israeli assault then, and I was in touch with the late Michael Ratner, who was then head of the Center for Constitutional Rights, and Francis Boyle, who had represented the PLO and who had been advocating a move like this, because he did this for Bosnia in the 1990s. So he had been through this process of going to the ICJ and invoking the Genocide Convention. In addition, I had been tracking the International Criminal Court and its machinations and its refusal to do anything for the Palestinians or to in any way genuinely polarize with U.S. Dictates. And then you had so I actually wrote my first piece on my Substack, I think on October 8th, it, at multiple points about what was going to come down the line, which I think held up pretty well. And one of those things was saying that a country should immediately invoke the Genocide Convention. I had hoped that if a country had done so immediately, it might have prevented Israel from doing what it's done for the last 3 months. And then at a certain point, you had the prosecutor for the ICC go to the crossing between Egypt and Gaza as if to say, I'm the cop on the beat here, send your complaints to me. And a lot of people fell for that, thinking that the ICC would actually be of help. So I immediately knew that meant that an alternative mechanism had to be done, because a lot of people were you know, taken down a false path.
Yeah, yeah. Well, David, I mean, our report there, he pointed out that Elbit, which, as you know, is Israel's largest arms company, had a role in supporting apartheid in South Africa, and many of the war crimes being perpetrated by Israel today are likely being committed using Elbit weapons, aren't they?
Well, of course they are. And, of course, Elbit has many plants throughout the UK and in other countries too. And of course, a couple of them have been shut down by Palestine Action through their amazing activism. But, you know, here we are, and people talk about boycotting McDonald's for their supply to the IDF, and, of course, that's a good idea. But Elbit are actually producing weapons in this country, which are being used day and daily to kill Palestinians, over 100 children every single day. And it's an extraordinary position that we're in. And what we're faced with is the minister here, Grant Shapps, was saying just the other day that, you know, that Ansarallah and Yemen, it's nothing to do with Israel-Palestine. Yes. It's far away. It's thousands of kilometres away, you know, several thousand kilometres less than the UK is, of course. Indeed. But, of course, this is absolutely to do with what's going on. And it's being done in the UK, and it should be stopped forthwith. The government should step in and say, you can't do this anymore. I mean, the government should be enforcing this, but of course it's left to the extraordinary work of Palestine Action, which of course everyone should join and support.
Of course, we had that enormous rally in Yemen, didn't we, in Sanwar city, you know, supporting the action being taken in solidarity with the Palestinian people. So for Jack Grant to say what he was saying, I mean, it just clearly trying to pull all the wool over the public's eyes in this country. But Sam, how did you feel when you heard South Africa took the step to invoke the convention after you'd been, you know, pressing for it for so long?
Yeah, no, it was extraordinary. You know, I'd gotten wind about maybe 6 weeks ago that there was a cabinet meeting in South Africa. Because the parliament had wanted the cabinet to totally cut off relations with Israel, not just simply recall the ambassador. And I was fairly sure that they were also considering invoking the Genocide Convention. So I was very disappointed for some time that they didn't issue a statement after that cabinet meeting that they would be invoking the Genocide Convention. But reconstructing the timeline, it's quite possible that they had made that decision and that they had just simply been working on this 84-page application to do it as comprehensively as possible. And then they finally issued it, and I was overwhelmed. I had spent my energies focusing on some Latin American countries at this point, Colombia, Bolivia, some others to possibly this. Criticizing the Palestinian ambassadors for not publicly declaring their support for this, and so on. So it's been tremendous. And just about that time that the South Africans did that, a whole bunch of groups in the United States, I think, woke up to the possibility of the efficacy of this. And so you have a coalition now trying to get other countries to issue declarations.
Absolutely, yeah. But David, I mean, just say a word or two, will you, about the level of international support that there is for the case that South Africa's taken against Israel.
I think you've got to look at this in two ways. One is, when you say international support, of course, there's the question of states parties supporting this. And of course, it was South Africa at first, and it was only there for quite a while, and then all of a sudden a trickle of other countries joined, Bolivia amongst them, and then of course latterly Bangladesh joins, and you've got a whole list of countries, I think around about 20 now, possibly more.
Any Western countries?
No Western countries, no. And you have also, let's be clear, these are largely countries in Asia, Africa, and Latin America, not Arab countries. Now, of course, that's the rub, isn't it? Because it should be the Arab countries that should be involved, and Islamic countries that should be at the forefront of this. And that takes you to the second question, which is, of course, the international support for South Africa in public opinion. And that is, of course, overwhelming all over the world in every single country, with the exception, of course, of Israel.
Yeah.
So even overwhelming in the US. So, but what we see then is the step that South Africa has taken provides the way in for people to say, what are our, especially in the Arab world, what are our governments doing? I saw a massive demonstration in Cairo just the other day where they're saying, this brings shame upon us.
Yes,
South Africa is leading the way. It brings shame upon us that we haven't done this.
Absolutely. We're going to come back in a moment to the discussion, but we've got another report now about the proceedings at the ICJ.
As the proceedings at the International Court of Justice began and South Africa laid out their case, the world look on with hope. The South African legal team, featuring an Irish lawyer, meticulously constructed a compelling case that Israel has breached the Genocide Convention with its campaign in Gaza. However, as the hearing was taking place, Israel attacked civilian locations in two separate countries. An ambulance and health services building in South Lebanon in the town of Hanin, and civilians queuing for food in Gaza. At least 32 Palestinians, including women, children and men, were then killed by the Israeli army in Khan Yunis, southern Gaza Strip, with an airstrike during the International Court of Justice session. Clearly unashamed of Israel's warmongering ways, Israeli lawyers took to the International Court of Justice the following day to further attempt to justify the unjustifiable. Israel's lawyer, Malcolm Shaw, from Leicester University in Britain, came across as unorganized and arrogant. "Someone has shuffled my papers," he grumbled as he staggered through his address. A widely criticized move took place when Western news channels that ignored South Africa's presentation at the International Court of Justice live-streamed Israel's response to it in an act of censorship by omission. The German government has announced that it will seek to intervene in the International Court of Justice to support Israel. Possibly out of dread for its own fate, as German armament sales to Israel soared 1,000% in 2023, with a fast-tracking system established in October. As a result, Germany not only continued to arm Israel throughout its murderous war in Gaza, but even increased sales to boost Israel's ability to kill. Former British ambassador to Uzbekistan, Craig Murray, argued the result of the trial at The Hague will define the integrity of the institution. Israel is not on trial here. What's on trial is actually the International Court itself.
David, I mean, they say that one of the hardest aspects to prove in cases like this at the ICJ is intent. But, I mean, there's been a plethora, hasn't there, of statements from Zionist leaders that do justify the accusation of genocide, wouldn't you agree?
Well, you say a plethora. I mean, what's the plural of plethora? I mean, there have been so many. And we've talked about this in the programme before, you know, listing statement after statement, Netanyahu talking about Amalek, the people of Amalek being smited by... and, of course, that passage is from Scripture. And you know, Netanyahu, of course, is an atheist and the Zionists, by and large, are secularists. There's a religious Zionist fringe. But they're talking about there is, in that passage in the Bible, is when they say smiting the Amalek, they're talking about killing everybody and everything, the goats, the chickens, the hens, the men, the women, and the children, every single one. Yeah. And that's, of course, an incitement to genocide. And, of course, what they've had to show in South Africa is that this is an incitement to genocide and it's been carried out. And of course, they've done that very effectively by showing the IDF in Gaza jumping up and down, talking about wanting to kill the Gazans. So it's an absolutely clear-cut case. Yeah. Of course, the response from Israel is to say, well, these are just some politicians. They're not really important. And of course, these are the politicians who are in charge.
Indeed,
I mean, it's absolutely extraordinary.
Yeah, no, indeed. Sam, I mean, what do you make of Germany vowing to come to Israel's aid?
Yes, well, you know, they're batting 1,000, I suppose, the Germans are. You had the very, very interesting response by the Namibians, given the history of German massive oppression of Namibia, chime in very effectively. And it's quite possible that Namibia will counter with a declaration at the court. You had Bangladesh and Colombia state that they will do so. You've had about 30 countries make some kind of statements regarding the court, but few of them have said that they will issue actual legal declarations. So it's important that more of them do that as soon as possible, I believe. But you have this pattern of the West, you know, and obviously not just Germany, but, you know, you fully expect the British government, the U.S. government, of course, has been completely dismissive of what South Africa has done, that continue this imperialist posture, basically, of enabling and being complicit with Israel's crimes.
Yeah, absolutely. David, I mean, what's your assessment of the performance at the ICJ of Israel's representative? What's his name? Malcolm Shaw. I mean, it was quite extraordinary, wasn't it?
It was. I mean, he's got a tough hand to play, and he played it very badly. So, you know, I mean, there he is, like you saw in the film there, shuffling his papers, not sure where he was. And he actually said in the court, you know,
yes.
Has someone shuffled my papers?
Indeed. This is supposed to be a top KC.
I mean, and there we are. That's the best that Israel could come up with. But, you know, of course, it's a very difficult hand to play because everybody in the world can see that this is a genocide, and there's no question about that. And we have to only wait and see what the court itself makes of it.
No, indeed. Well, Sam, I mean, I wonder what you could say. I mean, can you believe that even while delivering their case, the Israelis bombed Lebanon and committed a massacre, another massacre, in Khan Yunis at exactly the same time?
Yeah, it's extraordinary, but it is part of a pattern with them. You know, when the UN General Assembly overwhelmingly voted for a ceasefire, you saw a similar spike in attacks against Gaza. And this has a long history. You know, every time a U.S. Secretary of State in the past, when, you know, there has been some criticism of Israel, you know, they would go and say, you know, you really got to stop this settlement building, for example. And then as soon as they, you know, left Israel, Israel would announce that it was going to build a new settlement, a new colonial settlement on the West Bank, for example. So there's this pattern with Israel of any time a demand is made for it to abide by international law, that it immediately escalates. And you saw that with Netanyahu's speech. I really hope that the International Court of Justice takes a very good look at Netanyahu's speech following the case, where he basically said, no one, not The Hague, not anyone's going to stop us. Completely lawless statements.
Yeah, I mean, David, what's your prediction for the ICJ process?
Well, Sam's point there is the opposite one, about it being completely lawless. And that's what we've got to remember here, that this is a state which isn't going to pay any attention even to the U.S., if it can get away with it, it will just ignore and defy the U.S. Of course, if the U.S. did take serious steps against them, they would have to collapse. But they don't care about this. They see themselves as an imperial nexus themselves. They're not just the tail of the dog in their conception. They are there to expand to a greater Israel and take over, you know, much of what we now call the Middle East or West Asia. So what's going to happen, of course, in the case itself? I would guess that the court is going to say that there should be a ceasefire, and they're going to order a ceasefire. But this is a lawless state. I mean, you know, when the court makes these kinds of judgments, states may not comply with them. And if we were betting people, we would put all of our money on the fact that Israel will not comply with a judgment that there should be a ceasefire. But if there is a judgment that there should be a ceasefire, which I think there probably will be, then this will be a tremendous advance for the Palestinian cause. But it's only a tremendous advance in terms of ideas and the informational battle. There still has to be the question of what actually happens in Palestine.
Mm, indeed. And Sam, you know, if that does happen, if there is a finding that Israel is committing genocide, there is also reports, aren't there, circulating now, that Britain and the United States could find themselves in the dock for their collaboration in the and for the facilitation of the genocide that's actually happening now.
Yes. Well, there was already a lawsuit from the Center for Constitutional Rights against the United States domestically. I haven't taken a look at the I've heard of, but I haven't taken a look at the recent British case. If it's being done at the ICJ, it could well have an effect on Britain. You know, they don't have a reservation on the relevant Article 9 of the Genocide Convention as the U.S. does. So that there could well be, there should be follow-up. I mean, hopefully what South Africa has done here will open up several doors for further avenues, legal and otherwise. It should bolster, for example, the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement. You could have the General Assembly asserting itself in a meaningful way. There are several things that should follow from this.
Yeah. And in a word, and very briefly, Sam, because we're almost out of time, I mean, what's your prediction? Are you optimistic?
I'm trying to be realistic. I'm reminded that Catherine Gunn exposed that the U.S. and Britain spied on U.N. Security Council members during the buildup of the Iraq invasion. So I don't know what pressure is being put upon the court now.
Right.
So hopefully rule on the merits.
Indeed. Well, we live in hope, and time will tell. But I'm afraid we are out of time. That's it for this week. So I'd like to obviously thank our guest, Sam Hosseini, and, of course, our resident expert, Professor David Miller. Palestine Declassified will be back next week with more forensic investigations and analysis. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day, from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day, from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. Now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
Gaza health administrators recognized Zionist regime's systematic campaign against medical facilities and workers as soon as it began. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, soon after Dr. Ghassan Abu Seteh arrived at Al-Auda Hospital in the northern Gaza Strip in October, an Israeli regime officer contacted the director and threatened to target the facility if it wasn't evacuated within 2 hours. This was the first message from the Israelis that the primary target of this war would be the health sector. Ghassan Abu Seteh, a British-Palestinian surgeon, arrived in Gaza on October 9th and volunteered there for more than a month. During a speech delivered in Arabic in Beirut in December, Abu Seteh analyzed how the Zionist regime's attacks on the medical sector were a critical strategy of its campaign of ethnic cleansing and genocide against Palestinians in Gaza. Gaza health administrators recognized the Zionist regime's systematic campaign against medical facilities and workers as soon as it began. Abu Seteh told the Beirut audience there were phone calls not just with the health ministry, but also between hospitals and hospital managers. A decision was made that the purpose of evacuating hospital was to facilitate the process of ethnic cleansing that the enemy aimed for. Abu Seteh, who was at the Al-Ahli Arab Hospital in Gaza City when it was bombed on October 17, says that the shocking incident set a precedent of international complacency that allowed the Zionist regime to systematically attack health facilities throughout Gaza. Independent analyses conducted remotely haven't conclusively determined who was responsible for the explosion at the hospital, but Abu Seteh contends that it was a trial run by the Zionist regime, which received a signal from the West to carry on with its plan after the bombing at the Christian hospital with strong international sites. Several pediatric hospitals and specialized treatment centers were targeted. In one particularly harrowing case, the Zionist regime military left several Palestinian babies to die in their small beds at Anas Pediatric Hospital in the northern Gaza Strip after it was raided by troops. 4 tiny infants died starving, cold, and alone, their decomposed bodies found weeks later. The Zionist regime's attacks on Gaza medical facilities reached its apex with the raid on Ashifa, the largest and most advanced hospital in the territory, after laying siege to it for days. Ahead of its assault on Ashifa, the Zionist regime spread propaganda amplified by U.S. officials purporting that the resistance group Hamas was using the facility as a command and control center. As the Zionist regime's lies about Gaza's health sector crumbled one after another, so too did any pretense that the systematic destruction of Gaza's health sector would generate international condemnation or intervention. The Zionist regime now hardly bothers to justify its ongoing attacks on health facilities. More than half of Gaza's 36 hospitals have completely shut down and none remain fully operational. Abu Seteh said that the Zionist regime has systematically attacked medical professionals with the aim of eliminating an entire generation of doctors. The Israeli objective, according to Abu Seteh, is that even if you rebuild your hospitals, you wouldn't be able to build the health sector. He said that the Zionist regime's army even destroyed solar panels placed on hospitals, so they wouldn't have to rely entirely on fuel, the supply of which is controlled by the Zionist regime. The Zionist regime's ultimate aim is to make Gaza unlivable, to force the expulsion of its population, Abu Seteh said. Palestinians met the Zionist regime's attacks with community and solidarity, Abu Seteh said. In the face of Israel's crimes abetted by the international community, Abu Seteh said, They were and still are acts of amazing heroism. Individuality dissolved and there was an emergence of collectivity that Abu Seta said defends its humanity and civilization in the face of criminal barbarism. He said that Palestinian society decided to elevate its humanity by defending the weakest among them. People shared their resources and others stepped in and volunteered to keep a sense of community and dignity. At Al Ahli Hospital, Abu Seta recalled, there was a barber nearby. When we were cut off from the rest of the outside world, the barber volunteered to come and cut the hair of doctors and nurses. The next day, he volunteered to feed patients and cut their hair. Abu Seta said that a pharmacist came to the hospital after his business was destroyed to help with managing medications in the operating room. Abu Seta described these acts of solidarity as community resistance. After 43 days in Gaza, Abu Seta left after the hospital he was working at ran out of anesthesia. Years before the current crisis, Gaza's health system teetered on the brink of collapse. During 16 years of siege, repeated the Israeli regime military offensives, and the maiming of thousands of Great March of Return protesters. As the genocide drags on, 4% Gaza's population of 2.3 million has been killed, injured or missing. Three hospitals in the central and southern Gaza, Al-Aqsa, Nasser Medical Complex and Gaza European, are at risk of closure due to the issuance of evacuation orders in adjacent areas and the ongoing conduct of hostilities nearby, according to the UN Office of the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. Some hospitals in the Gaza City and north that were forced to shut down after Israeli regime attacks have resumed functioning to some degree, OCHA said recently, but those hospitals have a shortage of medical staff, including specialized surgeons, neurosurgeons and intensive care staff, as well as a lack of medical supplies, OCHA added. With the Zionist regime preventing supplies from reaching the north, there is an urgent need for fuel, food, and drinking water. The hospitals partially functioning in the south are operating at three times their capacity while facing critical shortages of basic supplies and fuel, according to OCHA. The Zionist regime forces hit Khan Yunis, the largest city in the south of Gaza, pounding areas near the enclave's biggest functioning hospital, Reuters reported. It is feared that it will be the next medical facility forced to evacuate by the Zionist regime as part of its systematic strategy to destroy and depopulate Gaza.
Economic divide.
As the U.S.-Israeli genocidal war in Gaza has passed 100 days, the Israeli regime is trying hard to portray an image of success in the battlefield, but it has failed to do so. When it comes to the economy itself, it's also suffering due to the genocidal war. But it is becoming clear that a shortage of manpower is one of the toughest challenges that it is facing, amongst others, since with employees, or without them, I should say, how can it have an economy? Hello, welcome to Economic Divide. These are some of the highlights that we'll be looking at. The settler violence when it comes to the occupied West Bank economy is a big problem. This has impacted the economy there, canceled work permits on top of that, and of course the intensified restrictions, making things very hard. Also, the Palestinian Authority tax revenues again being withheld by Israel. For example, last month, almost $140 million. As a result, salaries have not been paid. Then, moving on to another highlight of the economy, we focused on Israel in terms of the multifaceted crisis that Israel's economy is facing. One of them is lack of investment, or I should say low consumer confidence, which then you have a lack of investment. These are all plaguing the economy and dragging it down. Israel's genocide on the people of Palestine in Gaza and the occupied West Bank has cost thousands of lives. The onslaught has also plunged the territories into an economic crisis. Since October 7, Israel has stepped up military raids in the West Bank, and violence by Israeli settlers has increased sharply. Escalating violence by the Israeli military and settlers intensified restrictions on mobility, tens of thousands of canceled work permits, and the withholding of tax revenues from the Palestinian Authority are combining to tip the territory into a humanitarian crisis. With hundreds of thousands losing their jobs, Palestinian families are experiencing poverty, in addition to an overall drop in the quality of life amidst an absence of safety. The International Labor Organization estimates that Israel's revocation of work permits for Palestinians has eliminated around 208,000 jobs, about 24% of all employment in the occupied West Bank. Access restrictions to Israel's labor market has cost the Palestinian economy losses at around $500 million since October the 7th, with the unemployment rate to have reached a record 52%. For tens of thousands of government employees, the situation is also bleak. Time now to find out what has been posted online on this topic. First, we take a look at the website that stated, as the Gaza war, we call it an onslaught, dominates, Israeli actions tip the West Bank into an economic and security crisis. It said, you don't know what new checkpoints will be set up and which group of settlers you will be attacked by. Next up, a viewer comment called St. Thomas said that tourism has come to a virtual standstill and spending has jumped. The hit to tech companies has shaken confidence in a sector that has become a key driver of Israel's economy. The call-up of 350,000 Army reservists disrupted operations at many companies. Many customer orders were put on hold or canceled outright. As the crisis in Gaza worsens, so does the economic situation in the West Bank, as Israel withholds $150 million a month to the PA. That's the Palestinian Authority. That means the PA is unable to pay its security forces at a time when the West Bank is boiling. And finally, another viewer comments by the name of IB Nomer, there's nothing, no Israeli tourists, no non-Israeli tourists, no weddings, no henna celebrations before the weddings, no housewarmings. Ouch, that hurts. Let me introduce our guest for the first section of the Q&A. First up, we have David Hungerford. David Hungerford is an author and economist. David Hungerford, welcome to Economic Divide. All eyes are on the humanitarian situation in Gaza. That's a given. 100 days is past even that. This genocide is continuing. But at the same time, you have an economic crisis unfolding. You're looking at the way that funds are evaporating. You don't have a budget that can keep up with the war costs. How severely has this genocide or war impacted West Bank's economy, both for the Israel and the Palestinians, for that matter?
Well, we're talking about, I think, here primarily about cross-border workers. That is to say, workers who live in the West Bank and commute to work in Israel. So that has been interrupted, and that's quite a large economic volume, particularly locally, around $5.5 billion USD per year. So that's being badly disrupted, and it's going to be contributory, over the longer run to Israel's difficulties in this situation.
All right, thank you for that. Joe Quinn joins us now. Joe Quinn is an editor at SOT.net. Joe Quinn, welcome to Economic Divide. Our guests there talked about the worker crisis. Here we have another crisis that's been ongoing for quite some time, but it has increased, and that's these vicious settlers who are attacking Palestinians. At the same time, the restrictions on mobility has increased multifold. Tens of thousands of canceled work permits, which goes to the Palestinian workers, and the withholding of tax revenues from the Palestinian Authority, they're all contributing to this economic crisis. But all of these problems are originating from Israel. Why is Israel shooting itself in the foot this way?
Well, yeah, pretty much every problem that the Palestinians have originates with Israel. Of course, when a state like Israel, with the backing of the West, initiates that kind of genocidal policy against an entire people, well, yeah, they're doing it across the board. They're not just bombing. They're trying to create intolerable living conditions for. They're obviously creating intolerable living conditions for the people of Gaza through bombing them and evicting them from their homes. But they're also focusing very much on the West Bank, and like I said, they've cut off all of the pretty much all of the jobs that the vast majority of jobs that Palestinians were doing in Israel. They have been cut off. And they also have been retaining funds, the Palestinian Authority's tax revenue that Israel has long had control over and sometimes restricts or sometimes allows them. They basically cut that off from the beginning of October 7th. They cut off that tax revenue, so the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank is having a lot of trouble actually functioning as a kind of government for the Palestinian people in the West Bank. And that on top of a significant reduction in jobs is creating, a serious economic crisis. But it's all by design, by Israel. It's on purpose. It's part of a plan, obviously.
Time now for the infamous section of the program. Our first item is something we covered in the last week, but there's an update to it in a way. First, the topic itself is the Israeli troop withdrawal from the U.S.-Israeli genocidal war. Now, Israel has said that it's going to pull several brigades from the Gaza Strip, the northern part to be exact. We heard that piece of news before. We covered it here at Economic Divide last week. But this is where it gets interesting. The military has said a growing toll on the Israeli economy after nearly 3 months of wartime mobilization with little end in sight to the fighting. Okay, aside from that, the fact that it's a growing toll on the Israeli economy, that speaks volumes, because many are saying there's a shortage of manpower that's affecting the economy. But it's a shortage of people contributing to the economy, like the reservists, which is said to be around 300,000, give or take, is the problem with the economy. Interesting point there. All right, move up Israel's economic crisis, as if we haven't covered that in this program. This particular entry said how the war in Gaza has taken a toll on the economy there. And it said that the Israeli military is sending these soldiers home from Gaza. And again, this is emphasizing what I just said before. In order to re-energize the economy, which faces a massive labor shortage because of the war. So here you have it. You have the two different angles when it comes to this. Is it a combination of both, or is it the fact that there's a shortage of people contributing to the economy? I'll leave the answer to that question up to you. Another aspect of the war, the occupied West Bank, is being affected by this U.S.-Israeli onslaught, as those wartime curbs have ravaged the West Bank economy, from stores to startups, restrictions on movement, for example, and also cuts to the Palestinian Authority. Let's not forget that Palestinian Authority has to pay their staff. They're not getting the money for it. That's a repeated move by the Israeli regime. And because of that cash shortage, it has put businesses at risk. Now, in terms of the way that we looked at this, we also wanted to add this piece of information. Since the onslaught began, Israel has almost entirely stopped allowing Palestinians from the occupied West Bank to enter Israel for work. So obviously that impacts the economy of the West Bank. Next up, another impact of the Israeli onslaught, and that's on the prices of energy. The World Bank warning of energy prices price surge if the Middle East war, which we call West Asia, spreads. And it's a new economic report which predicted a year of weak growth and said that the world faced a decade of wasted opportunity. Well, based on that, we figured we need to give our two cents, as they say here. And our analysis is the converging crises in recent years have put the world economy on track for the weakest half decade in 30 years, okay, based on the research we did. Without a major course correction, the 2020s will go down as a decade of wasted opportunity.
You're listening to Economic Divide. This series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
Israel's labor shortage has created a big headache for the economy. It's not easy to fix a manpower shortage, like a shortage, for example, of cash. Although Israel has brought in foreign workers, unfortunately for them, the problem still persists. Let's take a look at some of the costs that are involved. Well, the costs attributed to the absence of workers and a decline in productivity due to the complete closure, for example, of schools or educational institutions, that cost is quite high. We're looking at a cost of roughly about $325 million. Now, consider that based on what I just mentioned, $325 million, okay? Let's take a look now at the other aspect of this where there's costs involved. There is the absence of work. The previous one was workers. This is the absence of work. 144,000 evacuated residents from war-affected areas. The total cost that is incurred because of that is $154 million, all right? And then finally, we want to take a look at the cost that results in this case in points. Again, we're looking at the cost cumulatively. This would be based on the reservist recruitment. We have mentioned this quite a bit. But we're looking at, this is an updated number, of about 360,000 Israeli reserve soldiers. The cost that is incurred on that is roughly the figure that we have here, $130 million. That's the total tally there. Now, what we want to do, so you can get an idea before we move on to our guest, is to get an idea about the, all the costs that we mentioned in terms of the total. So you have the absence of work, that's $325 million. You have the absence of workers, which incurs a cost of $154 million. And finally, the reservist recruitment, that cost is $130 million for a total of $609 million. Obviously, that's a lot of money, especially given the fact that you're looking at a war economy of some sorts. All right, let's bring in our guests and see what they think. David Hungerford rejoins us. He's an author and economist. David Hungerford, welcome back to Economic Divide. We're looking at Israel's economy and how it's bleeding in so many different ways, but one of the major ones is a shortage of workers. We're also looking at the crisis there, the restriction that it has placed on Palestinian workers from the West Bank. They're not allowed to work as part of their staff there. Tell us what you see Israel's economy and how it's going to move from this point on.
Exactly. I mean, and that's very badly disrupting Israel's economy. In terms of the West Bank, it's hurting things in terms of take-home pay. And that's certainly a very important aspect of any economy, but it's just going to be mean all kinds of economic activity in Israel itself grinding to a halt. And, this war, it's, Israel cannot afford a long war. It needs a quick decision, and things aren't heading in that direction at all. And I think this is indicative of the overall trend.
Yeah, indeed. It doesn't look like this is going to end anytime soon. However, some may disagree, but Joe Quinn, editor at Sot.net, joins us. Let's see what he thinks. Joe Quinn, welcome back. I'm taking a look at Israel's economy in this question for you, and I'm not too sure what to ask you, but what's standing out week after week is the major problem with the shortage of workers. Aside from that, obviously the Palestinian restrictions since the work permits have been taken away has added fuel to the fire. But overall, Israel's economy is not doing well. And given the fact that this onslaught, genocidal war is going to continue. How do you see Israel's economy and also the one in the West Bank, occupied West Bank?
I think they're willing to take a temporary, as they say, a temporary hit to their economy in that respect, in terms of the Palestinians who are doing menial jobs in Israel, the job that Israelis didn't want to do. They're willing to suffer that, the consequence of that for in the short term. I think they do have a plan to, as part of their genocidal campaign against the Gazans, they have a plan to deal definitively with their quote-unquote Palestinian problem. So Israel sees these shortage of workers that they've created, shortage of Palestinian workers, is only a temporary measure until they deal with it as they foresee it, and then afterwards they'll be able to restart. I don't think it'll work out that way for them, because generally speaking, most of what Israel plans to do doesn't work out very well for it. So we'll have to see, but I think it's only a temporary measure in their minds. But yeah, I think ultimately Israel is going, Israel economically, militarily, and in many other ways is not going to be the Israel that we've known until now for much longer.
Israel collects taxes on Palestinian imports and exports to both the West Bank and Gaza. It transfers the revenue after taking a 3% commission to the Palestinian Authority, but frequently it uses it to exert pressure on the Palestinian leadership. The PA has been left without enough funds to pay public employees. An estimated 900,000 people in the occupied West Bank are in need of humanitarian assistance. Furthermore, around 95% of the donations made to the Palestinian Red Crescent are being directed to Gaza. That has left the West Bank in a desperate situation. Apart from that, Israeli settlements, military checkpoints, and roads designated for use by Israelis only already made traveling between areas of the West Bank difficult and time-consuming. Israeli authorities have further divided the West Bank into isolated areas over the past 3 months, disconnecting provinces and towns by installing dozens of new checkpoints. The tense atmosphere and closure in the occupied West Bank have affected almost all sectors of society. The UN estimated in 2019 that the Israeli occupation cost the Palestinian economy some $47.7 billion in fiscal revenues between the years 2000 and 2017.
Hello and welcome to the Quick Take section. I'm Matti Apossian. In this section, we'll cover two important sectors, the auto sector in Israel and the construction sector. In terms of the stats, the industry is only working at 30% capacity. Some 50% of construction sites are closed. The economic damage is $830 million a month. Keep in mind that the building and real estate sectors owe banks and non-banking institutions a little over $107 billion. Even if a small part of the debt is not repaid, it will be a huge hit for the whole economy. Many are not aware of the important role that the auto sector plays in Israel's economy and how much it contributes to Israel's GDP, and more importantly, the relation to the Yemeni army's targeting of Israeli-linked vessels. This was first revealed by CTEC under its title, the Israeli economy's greatest growth generator is also its biggest enemy, where it said that the biggest boost to Israel's economy in 2019 came from new car purchases. That year, economic data revealed that the gross domestic product increased at an annual rate of 4.1% after a growth rate of only 0.8% in the second quarter of the year. And this is where the Yemeni army targeting of Israeli-bound vessels comes in. The attacks have impacted the port of Eilat to the point that it is close to not functioning at all. The port of Eilat is the port that Israel received most, if not all, of its car imports. Any rerouting of vessels with cars impacts the final price tag of the cars, and that is not something that Israelis can afford. And this is what Israel is facing. Vehicle market collapses at 41.8% in November. Israeli vehicles market in November 2023 following the Hamas attack fell for the second month in a row. And that does it for this quick take section of the program.